The BioWorld Insider Podcast.
This is the BioWorld Insider Podcast. I'm Lynn Yaffe, BioWorld's publisher. Radiopharmaceuticals have been used for a long time for diagnostics, but radiopharmatherapies are entering a new era. They are becoming widely accepted as a key tool in the oncology armamentarium. They have the potential to provide patients with a big bump in efficacy, with fewer side effects and less damage to healthy tissues. BioWorld just launched a 7-part series taking a deep dive into this evolving technology as a disruptor in the cancer treatment space. Today, BioWorld staff writer Lee Landberger talks with another BioWorld staff writer, Tamara Sammy, the lead writer for our series. Over to you, Lee.
Thanks, Lynn. Radiopharmaceuticals have entered a new fast-paced era indeed, and the chronology begins a long time ago, 1895. 3 years later, Marie and Pierre Curie discover radium rays. Then in the 1950s, there was just the one therapy, that was iodine, and that was the only one until the early 2000s. But a lot has happened in the past 20 years, and Tamara spent the past few weeks looking into all this. Tamara, those years have been particularly strong. Can you give me a sort of a capsule summary of why there's been so much advancement in the past couple of decades?
Surely. Thanks for having me. I think the global interest really took off after some big deals in the space. It was around the same time that Bayer-Shovigo was approved in 2013 by the FDA, and that was for prostate cancer patients with bone metastases. And around the same time then, Novartis spent about $6 billion in acquisitions, acquired Endocyte for $2 billion, and with that inherited Pluvicto, which uses lutetium, and that was for prostate-specific membrane antigen prostate cancer. That really opened up the space into a wide patient population. And I think more than anything, the deal dollars is what really sparked interest globally. And then Bayer also made another big acquisition shortly after that, moving into another prostate cancer space. So since then, since 2016, approvals have picked up and FDA has green-lighted more imaging agents, which, you know, tie into the therapeutic side. That's kind of a point-and-shoot model. But yeah, they're now moving into, you know, the therapeutic space. So there's a lot in the pipeline right now.
So when you look at the technology and the big corporate players involved like Novartis, when you're looking at the technology, what is it is it the technology that's become so advanced and the larger companies are snapping up those that are developing it?
Well, that's part of it, but it's also, it's really merging chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So, you know, with this age of personalized medicine, now we're targeting things, we're much more specific, and now we're taking, you know, nuclear medicine, and we're attaching, you know, these radioactive elements onto these radioligands, which are able to target the cancer more specifically. So the ones that are really taking off, they're called theranostics, or it's kind of the point and shoot model, where first they take a small amount of radioactivity and image a patient. So then they're able to target that exact point on the tumor where it lights up. So that's why it's called point and shoot. Somebody else said, I think it was Steven Schuster with Isotope Technology. He says, you see what you treat and you treat what you see early on in drug development. And so as the radioisotope accumulates at the tumor site, it decays and releases that radiation. And then the other thing is these things have a pretty short half-life. So then, you know, the radioactive material just kind of putters out. I guess the main thing is that now we're able to target the tumor site directly without damaging the tissue around it. And then the other thing that this also offers is it offers the opportunity to speed up dosing optimization because you're looking at it, you're tracking it through imaging, you can see where it's being, you know, taken up. You can see where it's being distributed so that maybe down the road they won't have to do the dose ascending studies in quite the same way because they can see what the tumor is taking up and it provides additional information there.
So those are the big corporate players and that's what they're doing. I read in the series that there are certain countries and they look like they're European countries that are the leaders in the radiopharma space. Why is it that they're ahead of everyone else?
Well, there's a couple of things that make it interesting. So actually, Australia is also one of the leaders. Australia and Germany and Belgium, and then a couple of people that we spoke to said France as well. So Australia is interesting because Australia is sometimes a test market because of its small population. So often innovative therapies, players will go into Australia first and test a therapy. But the main reason, it all has to do with supply, Lee. So Germany has a large supply. And so those companies that were able to really tamp down the supply chain are pretty much leading the industry right now. You know, Novartis is, you know, one of the biggest players, but it has been riddled with supply issues. So there's a couple of companies that seem to have an edge. You know, Isotope Technologies in Munich has a leading edge, and it's got a monopoly on supply. A lot of these players early on saw that, and so they bought up the supply chain to tamp that down, and they appear to be the leaders in the space right now. Australia's Telix is one of them.
So tell me about, you're talking about supply challenges, but the United States seems to lag behind.
The United States is lagging behind. And, you know, it's interesting because on the one hand, Canada has a large supply. There have been supply shortages in Canada, though. Shortages of the raw material for the isotopes have caused some problems. But another problem is also that these therapies have very short half-lives, right? So some of them are only active for like 6 or 8 hours. So you can't, so if you're manufacturing in Germany, you can't really ship that, right? Because it's only going to be alive for 6 hours. So you have to be close to your supply chain. So it's an interesting space. And when you think about, you know, these are nuclear medicines and they really arose from nuclear weapons, right? That were made back in the 1940s with uranium. And so a group called the Manhattan Project, you know, figured out that plutonium gave higher yielding weapons and that was more effective. So in the 1980s, there was a campaign to extract what was thorium-229 from that stockpile of uranium. And that was pretty much split into two batches. One batch stayed in the US and the other batch went to Germany. So that's pretty much the entire global supply of actinium right now. And then lutetium had similar issues. There's a limited number of these, are, you know, they're produced in a nuclear reactor, and there's a limited number of nuclear reactors. In like 2008 to 2010, there was a global shortage of several main isotope producing centers in Canada and the Netherlands, causing delays to patient treatments. And then recently with Novartis, it had some issues with supply and has stopped treating patients because of those similar issues. So another, I guess, wrench in the system, and the United States should be able to do this better than Europe, is, you know, the regulatory red tape, because you're not just being regulated by, say, the FDA. You're being regulated by the nuclear regulator when it comes to transporting this radioactive material. You've got clinical regulations. So you've got these layers of regulations. Now, in Europe, you know, you don't have, you're crossing countries and you can't ship the material from country to country. So say if you're a supplier in Germany, you can ship to the United States, but you can't really ship out across other European countries, which seems a bit nuts, right? But it's making for a very difficult space to enter. And so the supply issue seems to be everything in this space, more so than in any other space that I've seen.
Let me ask you another question. I was curious, earlier on, you mentioned how there's a shorter half-life for these treatments, and that means being a patient is a different experience than it used to be. Shorter half-lives, less damage to tissue. Can you give me an idea of what it's like being one of these patients now, as maybe compared to a few years ago?
Well, you know, when, so for example, with iodine, as a patient, if you came in to be treated, you would have to isolate for 48 hours in a solitary room because everything was radioactive. Your waste material was radioactive. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. I mean, the patient's waste material is still a bit radioactive, but it's not a cause for concern anymore. And from the companies that we've spoken with, this is an area where simply companies like Bayer and Novartis being in the space have pretty much trained the clinicians. So clinics are well versed in how to handle these new types of radioactive material. They have to get a license from the Nuclear Regulatory Council. And there's enough of them in academic medical centers that deal with these that they have services that deal with the radioactive material. So it's not really an issue for the patient anymore. You know, they don't have to isolate. They pretty much get treated and may have to hang out in a room for, usually it's just a few hours, and then go on home. You know, I was hearing stories of patients that had to be isolated in another room in their home. And that was more in the old days with iodine, but that's not the case anymore. So we've learned a lot about how to deal with this.
And are these treatments more effective?
Well, iodine was very effective, but it had also carried a lot of damage. So, you know, we've gotten better at targeting, just, you know, in the age of personalized medicine, we're better at targeting specific biomarkers and specific proteins. So as is the case generally in treating cancer, we're getting more specific. And so these radioactive ligands, like targeted cancer therapies, will just target that particular protein. So we think that they'll be more effective, particularly with metastatic cancer. Not only will they be more effective, but they'll also cause less damage. At least that's the great hope. We haven't seen enough approved yet to be sure, but it's looking pretty good from the people I've spoken with.
So we've come a long way in the past 20 years, and I'm curious, do you have an idea of what the future looks like with this technology?
Well, from the people that we've spoken with, it's another tool in the oncology toolbox. And it seems like the direction is getting more and more specific. Get it early, you know, and that really is the cure. Diagnose it early, find it. Patients will still have surgery to take out a tumor, but now we'll be able to monitor it continuously. You know, we have the right target, the right ligand. You know, if it starts to spread, it becomes easier to treat. With metastatic disease, you know, when surgery isn't an option, these radiotherapies are going to really help instead of external beam radiation where, you know, you just kill everything around you. This and chemotherapy that has a myriad of side effects, you know, this really could be a strong tool in the toolbox to help these patients.
Got it. Thanks, Tamara. This series is fascinating. I urge everybody to read it. It's running this week in BioWorld, and it'll be up on our site for a while. So thank you for all you did, and great job.
Thanks, Lee.
And Lynn, back to you.
Thank you, Tamara and Lee, for these insights. For our listeners who would like to learn more about this topic, check out BioWorld's multi-part special report, Radiopharmaceuticals, the Next Big Disruptor. As always, BioWorld will continue to keep you informed of all the most important scientific, clinical, and business updates. That's our show for today. If you need to track the development of drugs, turn to BioWorld.com. Follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at newsdesk@BioWorld.com. Also, if you're enjoying this podcast, don't forget to subscribe. Thanks for joining us.
BioWorld, published by Clarivate, is a subscription-based news service that delivers actionable intelligence on the most innovative therapeutics and medical technologies in development.